The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here. Welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. This is just a note to say that if you are hearing this, then you are not currently part of my membership programme and will only be hearing the first part of each show. In order to access full episodes of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will need to become a member of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, via the link in the description associated with this podcast. Welcome, dear listeners, to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. It's Sarah here, the Tudor Travel Guide. And in this episode, you join me on location in the fair county of Surrey to visit West Horsley Place. Now, this is a new place to me. I have not been here before, but as you will hear in the podcast, it is steeped in some magnificent Tudor history. And in particular, later this year, in July, there is a Tudor-themed event of magnificent proportions going on here to celebrate a very special royal visit. Well, more on that to come. But I do urge you, on this occasion, take a look at the show notes. The link, of course, as ever, is in the description associated with this podcast. You will find some notes, some important links, and also some images that will be illustrating some of the things that we'll be looking at and talking about with our guest experts and guides today. Now, if you do look at the show notes page, you will see that West Horsley Place is not your typical Tudor property. In fact, it has a distinctively Georgian facade. But that belies a very special Tudor history, as I say, associated with one of the great influential families of the Tudor age. And in this episode, guided by our expert guides, we will be hearing all about the history of the family associated with West Horsley Place, of the building itself, and of course, of that very special royal visit. So with that, I'd love to introduce our experts for today. I'll come to you, Anthony, first. Anthony Musson, you're from Historic Royal Palaces. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I'm head of research at Historic Royal Palaces, and I'm leading the project on Henry VIII on Tour, which is really investigating Henry VIII's progresses, which is why we're here today at West Horsley Place.
Because it's included as part of the project?
It has emerged as somewhere that is part of the project, because I wasn't actually really aware of its existence beforehand or its significance. And so it's now become very much of interest to the project.
Well, I'm glad it's not just me, because I hadn't heard really of West Horsley Place nor of its significance either. Well, thank you so much for taking time to join us today. And you're going to be talking mostly about the actual building and the use of the spaces, is that right?
Partly, yes, but also the progresses
and
Henry VIII.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And standing next to Anthony is James. James Clark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you just introduce yourself and let our audience know who you are and what you do and what's your association with West Horsley Place?
Of course. I'm Professor of History at Exeter University. I'm a late medieval and Reformation era historian, and I've been contributing to this project on the history of the family that held this place in the middle years of Henry VIII's reign. That's the Courtney family, whose main base is in the southwest of England, in Devon. And I've been investigating their archives over a number of years.
Brilliant. Okay, great. And in fact, we're going to start with you because I think it's a great place to start to set some background and context to West Horsley Place, the family that own this. And in fact, one of my followers actually just said to me today, oh, I'm so delighted that the event that's going to be happening here is actually happening in Surrey because I thought they were all associated with Devon. So maybe you could just tell us, for those people who don't know, who are the Courtenays and why were they so powerful and influential at court? And how come they were associated with this place here?
Okay, so to start with, the Courtenays are a long-established aristocratic family in later medieval England. And for about 150 years, by the reign of Henry VIII, they have held claim to the earldom of Devon. So it's right to say they are based in the southwest of England and they hold castles and large amounts of property in Devon, especially, which is their homeland, if you like. But by the reign of Henry VIII, new generation of the family have become increasingly close to the new Tudor king, Henry VIII. And in fact, Henry Courtenay had more or less grown up, spent part of his boyhood with Henry VIII. He's 7 years younger than Henry VIII, so he's a sort of younger friend, must look up to Henry VIII as a sort of older brother figure. Henry VIII born in 1491, Henry Courtenay 1498. He and his sister are at court in their early teenage years and are around Henry while he's still Prince Henry, before he takes the throne in 1509, and he soon becomes not just an old boyhood friend, but Henry's favourite. In many ways, he's sort of Henry VIII's forgotten favourite. He's the longest serving of those favourites. He's close to the king from the end of the first decade of Henry's reign right the way through to his downfall in 1538. So for almost 20 years, he's really at the heart of Henry VIII's court as his favourite, so much so that Henry VIII, in fact, makes Henry Courtenay's marriage for him. He brokers this marriage with noblewoman, Gertrude Blunt, from a leading aristocratic family. And by the end of the 1520s, they are a golden couple at court.
Can I ask anything? What do we know about Henry Courtenay's personality? Why did Henry VIII gel with him so much?
Well, in many ways, I think he's probably the young man that Henry VIII would like to be and perhaps fancies himself as being, in that he is fit, agile. He's got considerable physical prowess, as far as we understand it. He's one of the young knights who is in the tournament lists at the Field of the Cloth of Gold, the great pageant of 1520. And as far as we know from the records, when English and French jousters lined up against each other, it's Henry Courtenay who emerges as the most successful of the English players,
right,
in those jousting games. And so he's clearly a young, tough guy. And what we know, almost if nothing else, about Henry VIII is that's his own self-image. And of course, this is the young Henry VIII. This isn't the bloated, bitter Henry VIII of the end of his reign. But this is the Henry VIII of the 15 teens and 20s. And so in a sense, yeah, I think Henry Courtenay is a kind of alter ego of Henry VIII. He's also, today we would say, you know, a rather kind of damaged individual. He's had a really difficult young life. He might have grown up with the future king, but his father was in prison when he was a young lad. His father, heir to the earldom of Devon, but falls foul of Henry VIII's father, Henry VII, is suspected of plotting against the Tudor succession to the throne, and he's thrown into the Tower of London in 1504 when Henry Courtenay's just a 6-year-old boy. he is growing up then under the shadow of shame, of not knowing whether his father will emerge from prison. In fact, it's Henry VIII himself, perhaps as an expression of his affection for Henry Courtenay, that lets his father out of prison when he comes to the throne. So Henry Courtenay, I think, he's physically strong and impressive, but he's also clearly got a drive. He's got a lot to prove, having had that strange start in life at the heart of royalty, but at the same time carrying this sort of burden of shame also.
So when did he come into his patrimony? When did his father die?
Well, his father dies in 1511, so just 2 years into the new reign of Henry VIII. And quickly, Henry VIII again, seeing his young boyhood friend right, he does confirm titles and lands. And behind him, Henry has a very powerful woman in the shape of his mother. His mother, this is one of the most remarkable of all Tudor women, in Catherine Courtenay, as she was by marriage. But she's the daughter of King Edward IV. She is the, as she describes herself in her will when she dies in 1527, she is the daughter, the sister and the aunt of kings. It's the first line of her will. It's just remarkable survivor, political survivor. Mm. And I'm sure she is the power behind young Henry Courtenay. He recovers his titles and then she is sort of powering him to the centre of this new court life of the young King Henry VIII in the 15-teens. And she lives long enough to see him established. Henry is so affectionate towards young Henry Courtenay. He doesn't just make him Earl. By the 1520s, he's raised him just a notch above Earl to be Marquess. Mm. And so he becomes not just Earl of Devon, he's Marquess of Exeter. Mm. So he really is now a sort of prince of the West Country.
We'll be returning to the podcast very shortly, but I just wanted to take a few moments to remind all you Anne Boleyn fans out there that I am running an Anne Boleyn online experience from the 16th of June to the 25th of August alongside my co-founder of Simply Tudor Tours, Adam Pennington. We have a host of speakers who will be delivering lectures and giving live Q&A sessions throughout the course of this time. And if you're interested in booking your place, then please check out the link in the description associated with this podcast, where you can find out much more information about the event. Okay, let's go back to West Horsley Place.
I love this description of Catherine Courtenay. And also you used a phrase earlier on that perhaps Henry Courtenay is one of the forgotten favourites of Henry VIII. As you were talking about Catherine Courtenay, obviously I'm thinking about Margaret Beaufort as being another powerful woman, but I wouldn't think that many people would automatically then think about Catherine Courtenay. Why has she sort of disappeared? Why are the Courtenays perhaps not so well known as some of the other Tudor figures, do you think?
Well, I think ultimately because they have royal blood, but they don't have Tudor royal blood in them. They are Yorkists. Catherine is the daughter of the Yorkist king, Edward IV. And so although they are close to power, they are also always standing at that one remove from power after Henry VII is victor at Bosworth. And so the narrative of history that comes down to us is essentially a Tudor narrative. So they are necessarily left standing in the wings. Mm. But I think it's unfair. As a historian, I have to say, I haven't got a lot of patience with Lady Margaret Beaufort because, yes, she's a great endurer of life and husbands and so on, but she was also priggish and puritanical, this woman who was conspicuous in her piety in a really kind of frustratingly irritating way, I think. Whereas Catherine Courtenay isn't like that. She manages her estates herself. In fact, she holds on to a lot of the Devon property quite late on, doesn't give it to her son until quite late. So she's very independent, very autonomous. She's much more political. In, you know, for I think for a 21st century audience, she's a more interesting woman than this sort of rather self-consciously devout Margaret Beaufort.
Well, this is a slight sidestep. For those, if you've caught some people out there and you've caught me, I want to know more about her now. Where would we get the best information on Catherine Courtenay?
I think that's very difficult. I don't, with no intended offence to anyone, I don't think there's been a good biographical study. Coming from the West Country myself, I would strongly suggest paying a visit to the Courtenay home residence, as it were, of Powderham Castle, where there is material that directly connects us with Catherine, not least this wonderful letter, which tells, it's a letter written by her daughter from court to her mother, talking about how, because their father's in prison and they really are on their uppers, she's actually having to sell some of her clothes and her jewels just to survive at court. And incredibly poignant. But she's also really terrified of her mother. And it's this sort of teenage daughter, terrified of this rather formidable woman, Catherine Courtenay. So, so connect to the Courtenay heritage, really, in southwest England, Powderham Castle, which is near Exeter, Tiverton Castle also, which was the original base of the Courtenay family way back in the Middle Ages.
Right, interesting. Well, actually, you anticipated my next question, which was about their estates and their properties, which starts to connect us with West Horsley Place here. Obviously, you've mentioned their power base in Devon. So they, as most aristocratic families did, they didn't just have properties and estates around their base. They had properties in various parts of the country. This was clearly one of them. How did they come across owning West Horsley Place?
So it's a gift from Henry VIII. So Henry VIII has given young Henry Courtenay back the earldom of Devon. He's given him a place at court. He raises him to this grand status of Marquess, and he gifts him this place.
At the same time?
Progressively, over the course of the early 1520s, and of course he makes his marriage for him, and it's a natural thing to do for Henry VIII. He wants his favourite close by, and Henry VIII does often keep himself in a relatively sort of circumscribed network of palaces that he moves around. He spends a great deal of time at Greenwich Palace. He is very attached to where he spent much of his boyhood with his family at Chertsey Abbey, which is nearby here. So this, which is a royal possession at the time, West Horsley Place, is a natural gift to give your West Country favourite, who otherwise is having to go all the way back down to these old medieval castles in Devon. So it's much, much closer to the circuit that the court is making in and around the capital.
This is going to be a really obvious question, and you've half answered it, but I just want to be really explicit. Some people would say, why would you give away any nice property if you owned it? What was in it for Henry when he gave away properties to noblemen?
Well, it's part of maintaining that network of strongly supporting members of the aristocracy. Henry VIII knows only too well, and I think a degree of paranoia never quite leaves him, he knows only too well that the Tudors' hold on power is relatively tenuous. And so you build and broker alliances with the long-standing aristocratic families in the country. And you do that through transactions of one kind or another. You confirm titles that they've always claimed, or you give them new ones, you give them property. So what's in it for him is his continuance as king, ultimately. But also, you want them nearby. Henry isn't a great traveller, and the older he gets, the less he is inclined to do it. He does move around the southeast of England, and so to have such a significant figure at court nearby, we are certainly no more than a day's ride from Greenwich here.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out, because there are a lot of people out there who really, you know, are not familiar with UK geography.
Yeah, so. And I think people today probably are unfamiliar with how much ground even large households covered in a day. So a distance of anything between 30 and 40 miles, they would not balk at, even if on horseback and carriages and so on. So this is a convenient... It's probably about as far west as you would want to go if you were starting the day in Greenwich. So it keeps them nearby. It is also a very attractive property that Henry wants to keep under close eye. We don't know the full extent of the estate in the early 16th century, but we know that the hunting grounds here, or the hunting park here, was excellent. And Henry VIII is renowned, the letters in the 15-teens and 20s tell us, he's renowned for his love of deer hunting and his love of red deer at table as well, of venison. And he is going to come here for hunting because, again, this is the youngish Henry VIII. In the mid-1520s, Henry VIII is still only in his early 30s. And he is very, very keen on his hunting, as are the Courtenays when they come here, we know. Both Henry Courtenay, his wife Gertrude, and their little son Edward as well. They kit themselves out in hunting gear and spend many, many days here hunting.
We're going to continue the story of the Courtenays, and particularly Henry, and what happens to him. Doesn't end well. There's a spoiler for you folks. James is going to tell us all about that. But since we're talking about Henry moving around, I think this is a great time to move on and bring Anthony into the conversation. Because, as I mentioned in my introduction, there was a very special visit here in 1533. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Henry visits here in the end of July 1533. We've previously had his marriage confirmed with Anne Boleyn and her coronation then on the 1st of June. And that then kind of paves the way for him to kind of parade her, if you like, to the populace. And, you know, that's one of the things that this sort of progress that he embarks on. It's not an extensive progress. It may have been sort of cut short, shorter than he would have initially intended. And that's partly because Anne herself is heavily pregnant and he doesn't want to kind of risk the possibility that his son and heir will be damaged from her riding.
So, I mean, it's going to be a glorious time, isn't it? It's a month on from Anne being crowned, all their dreams and wishes, 6 years of waiting. It's all finally come to fruition. And now we're going to have a lovely mini progress, I suppose, around the home counties. And they come here to West Horsley Place. How do we know they came here? How do you find out information like that?
Well, normally the household accounts, the account wardrobe accounts, provide some detail as to where they went and the expenditure that occurs daily. Unfortunately, for those particular years, there isn't a detailed account, and so we have to rely on partially any kind of grants or warrants that are issued with his signet, which then shows that it's been done by him at a particular place, or letters that then are either dated from there, or we can work out where he actually was because of the time and place, and or who he's speaking to at the time or visiting, and we're not exactly told that he visits West Horsley on a particular day, but we do know that he visited sort of from Guildford, and there are a number of his courtiers who had houses around here, and obviously one of them was the Earl of Marquess of Exeter. And because we have this menu which specifically says that he was here on the 29th of July for a dinner at West Horsley with the Marquess of Exeter.
It's very handy.
It does then kind of, I sort of narrowed it down to being for 1533 because there is actually no year date there. But we're told in a letter from one of his courtiers, Sir John Russell, that Henry VIII was never merrier than when he was here, and he had some wonderful hunting, killed a stag, and you know, I think that kind of sets it to being here. And you know, there are a number of other sort of side references to it being West Horsley as the place that he visits.
Fantastic. And we're going to go inside in a minute and stand in what was part of the Great Hall, and I know James is going to talk to us a little bit about what they ate, because you know, we have, as you say, we have the menu. Amazing. But before we do that, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. First of all, the progresses in general. We're talking specifically on one level about the 1533 progress. But I think it's great to talk about progresses in general, because I get a lot of questions from people. Why? Particularly, why did they go on progress? I'd love us to talk about that. And also just maybe think a little bit about how a house like this would prepare for that visit. How did they know the king was coming? What kind of preparations did they make? So let's go to the first question, which is, how did a house like this know the king was coming?
Generally, there would be an announcement, perhaps 2 months in advance, that the king was preparing to journey into the provinces. His advisors, probably with his own sort of input, would draw up what's called jests, and these would then be sort of proclaimed. So they would establish a journey, a route, how long it would take them, or how many miles they would be doing per day, and where they would be staying, so that then the royal harbingers okay, could go out, and the clerk of the market and people like that, to get provisions and make people aware that the king was coming. And we know from correspondence and the chronicles that people did know that he was coming and made preparations, and you know, on the grapevine it went out that, oh, the king's coming, we need to make sure we've got accommodation.
And that's a good point. May I interrupt? Mm. Because obviously a house like this would have accommodated a certain number of people, but would the whole court be here, of, you know, like, what, could be 1,000 people in the whole court? Surely not. What kind of numbers would come to a place like this, and how would have they typically been accommodated?
The progress normally involved perhaps half the royal household. It wasn't ever the full amount. And we know from the 1526 Eltham Ordinances that there are a number of sort of stipulations as to how many people should come, and you know, what coordination there would be between the different departments in the household. Mm. And the interesting thing is that it probably it varied from progress to progress as to how many people actually were part of his entourage. Probably for this, it was actually would be a slimmed down version. mainly because he didn't want sort of too many people involved, and also it then hampers him in terms of being able to move around. So we don't know precisely how many people, as I said, because we haven't got the household account, so we can't tell in terms of the precise number of people that were catered for or whose stabling there was. You know, it could be 500 for a normal progress. For some of the big progresses to York, for instance, that may be, you know, a couple of thousand, possibly even more. Going over to Calais again, that was, you know, at least 2,000. So, you know, that really is quite a long train.
And it strikes me, having read about a few progresses, you highlighted York and Calais, which were almost like state occasions, weren't they? There was a point to be made, whereas this is a bit more, it feels more of a private visit to connect with the local aristocracy.
Yes.
And so maybe that's one way of helping everybody think about these progresses and the kinds of numbers that would be involved.
And I think even within a large progress, there could be sort of times when he's visiting smaller places, and at those times the court may have been accommodated in local towns, or they brought their own tents,
right,
in which case they then had a kind of a tented encampment, as it were, and you know, spent their time there. The king would normally stay in the best apartments in the place that he was visiting, although we do have one place, Acton Court, where we know that a wing was specially made in 1535 for his visit. And that was...
That's probably pushing the boat out,
yes,
isn't it?
Probably set the owner back significantly, but anyway.
Speaking of setting the owner back, I remember reading about, I think it was the 1535 progress, when he went to Basing House. I think it was Marquess of Winchester. I think there used to be a diary. I don't know whether you've ever come across this, because I read it once. And you know when you read something and then you can never find it again and it frustrates you like crazy. But I think there was William Paulet's diary. He'd made a note in the corner saying, this has cost me like a huge amount of money over just a few days. So the question of money, kind of what kind of cost would be involved in housing a progress over a couple of days?
That's very difficult to
Is
tell
really?
Because we don't have those kind of figures. There are some kind of global figures for the whole year's worth of provisions that we have for the 1520s, which off the top of my head I think are in the region of, would be now of, you know, about 2 to 5 million or something. I mean, it's something ridiculous.
Kind of scale.
Yes.
But that's useful just to know, you know, we're not talking about a few hundred or a few thousand.
No,
we are talking about a huge amount of money.
But Henry VIII wasn't, like Elizabeth, kind of sponging off the aristocracy in the same kind of way.
Yeah.
He did kind of... They were supposed to get receipts, and he did sort of pay his own way to a certain extent.
All right.
Although we do know also that when he came, there was a lot of kind of bring your own stuff. So people would provide some venison or, you know, chickens, whatever it is that they would from their local estate. So they'd be bringing in things. So it was not that it was like a horde of locusts coming there. I mean, they couldn't stay too long because they would have kind of eaten and drunk the place dry. So that's why they obviously did move on after a while.
And you mentioned the clerk of the market.
Mm.
There'll be a lot of people who go, what's that and what do they do? But I think it touches on the point that you were making there.
Well,
provisions.
They kind of fixed a price that was the kind of king's price for provisions, and normally it was a little bit below what the normal asking price was, so that the king would make sure that he'd got a good deal on that. That's obviously one of the interesting things about the accounts, and particularly local the household accounts, is actually being able to see what is provided for and how much they had to pay. Some of the sort of town council, borough councils that have detailed records on these things actually show how much was spent for certain things.
Right.
But the interesting thing, also going back to the Courtneys, is from the Courtney household accounts, we know that Henry and Gertrude and their young son joined in on certain progresses, because we have from the Courtney accounts details of where they went, and you know, their stabling arrangements and what they brought in and what they had for supper, and it's very interesting to have that kind of parallel then of someone who is actually on the King's progress and joining in on the way.
Oh, interesting. We're going to go inside in a minute, but I think we should talk about the exterior of the house before we go in. I mentioned in my intro that if you were visiting here, you wouldn't immediately say it's a Tudor house at all, largely because it's been refaced. So I would love you to maybe describe what we do see and then maybe try and give us a hint about what we would have seen if we were here in 1533.
Well, at the moment we see a very sort of 18th century type house with perhaps, I don't know, looks actually kind of vaguely Dutch in some ways. Those of you who may be familiar with the television programme Ghosts will know the exterior quite well. But it's very much brick-faced, and you wouldn't know that this was remotely a Tudor house. But this is really a kind of stuck-on facade, and that beneath there is or would have been half-timber-framed house with various wings extending that no longer do. And this, where we're standing now in front, would have been actually part of the first courtyard. There may have been a gatehouse here in traditional sort of Tudor fashion. There may have, at one stage, there was a moat. We don't know whether that was still in existence when Henry was here, but certainly it would have been imposing. Mm. And it's a place that we want to find out more about, because we don't have the records, or that the records are kind of fairly piecemeal, but it's something that if we have the both the archaeological and architectural experts in on in the future, could actually really uncover some very interesting things.
Well, maybe we could talk, because I know we're going to go in and we're going to go and look at some of the oldest bits. Mm. And you can point out some features, and maybe we can talk about what maybe some of the plans might be for learning more about the house. So just to summarise, what we had here is a double courtyard house. It was half timber framed house. Dating back to when?
I think the earliest part of it is the late 14th century, 1382, I believe. But most of it, I think, is from the early 15th century, so sort of 1425 okay. onwards.
So it's 100 years old by the time Henry comes here. So it's
yes.
already kind of a not an old-fashioned house, but it's a house of some antiquity.
Yes, but it's sort of spruced up then.
I bet.
And certainly when Henry VIII owns it, he extends it a bit further and adds stables and possibly some kitchens as well, just to enable it to better accommodate his court, which, although Henry Courtney himself is going to have quite a large establishment, and we know from the inventory that he does have a lot of servants and possessions. But obviously when Henry VIII comes here, or he's adding his own sort of weight of presence.
Mm. Mm. Well, I think we've been outside for quite some time. I don't know about you gentlemen, but it is a little bit on the chilly side. Spring has yet to arrive, so I think we're going to head inside and go into what was the Great Hall. And maybe, James, you can talk to us about what went on at the progress.
Thank you.
folks, you can probably hear by the tone of my voice that we are now indoors and very pleased for it. We can all defrost here. But I want to bring in another of our experts today, actually. Claire, hello, Claire. Claire
hello,
Clinton.
Hello.
You're the heritage manager here.
That's right. That's right. We're a small team, so we've got sort of multiple caps. But yes, the heritage manager, amongst other things.
Yes, OK. And hopefully you'll be talking to us shortly about the event that's going to be happening here, a really significant Tudor-themed event at the end of July.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just pick your brains about exactly where we are in the house, just to kind of help us orientate ourselves. Can you describe where we are and kind of which bits wings go off where and how they would have been
used? Absolutely. So as you've been hearing from Anthony, the house has got bigger and smaller over time, but it is still the same building that we're standing in. So we're in the central section of the house, which is the hall. It's called the Stone Hall. And we've got a large flagstoned chamber on the ground floor and another chamber above it. And this hall was rebuilt in two floors around 1500. But it still retains its medieval hall house layout, which you'll find across the country. So a central sort of great hall in the middle, a private family wing or a solar wing at one end, which in our case is the west end. So that's normally the sort of finest wing of the house. And then at the other end, so it's a sort of status, you know, it goes up and down in prestige, but at the other end of the house are the servants' wings and the kitchen. So the grander you are, the further sort of west
you get
in this house, exactly. But although this is still the same building, it's developed organically from the 15th century, so it's now a cross-section of different architectural, different decorative styles. And for us, it's a real challenge as a heritage organisation because we know we have this amazing untold sort of Tudor story, Tudor history, medieval fabric in the building. But it's almost impossible for us to share that with visitors because the house has now got a lot of decorative styles from later periods. So we can see standing in this hall that it's very classical. There's a classical decorative scheme in here. So for people at home, that means we've got columns, we've got pediments, we've got cornicing. Everything's very symmetrical and very even. Plasterwork, white, plain white, sash windows. So it completely disguises the fact that behind all of that is a great big socking sort of medieval timber frame and being held together with straw and mud. And, you know, it's incredibly fragile. And I don't know exactly how this room would have been decorated in 1533 when the king came to visit, but probably panelled, maybe hangings on the wall, tapestries, things like that. So it would have looked very different from how it looks now, even though it's exactly the same space that we're standing in. So we want to find a way through this project to help share that fabric, that those amazing Tudor stories and that really formative time in the development of the house with people that come to see us.
Actually, I think this would be a really good time actually just to talk about this event, because I know before we started rolling here with the recording, you were talking about how you're going to set this room up. So actually, can you just tell us what's going on at the end
I'd
of July?
Love
put
to.
Us out as our
I'd
space.
Love to.
Yes.
Because we are so excited about this. We, as you were saying, and Anthony was saying when you were chatting earlier, neither of you had really heard of West Horsey Place. Most people haven't. So this is a huge opportunity for us. We're an independent heritage charity, and we were set up very recently. The estate actually has a history that's at least a thousand years. We sort of know who was living here from the Saxon period onwards, although we know almost nothing about what buildings were here before the medieval ones that we've been talking about. But it's been in totally private hands all of that time, just until the recent couple of years. We're now open to the public. We need to save it. It's on the at-risk register. It's grade one listed. But just as importantly, we need to find ways that people can come and enjoy it, share it with as many people as possible, and explore its heritage and its history and share that with people. So for us as a very small charity, a very sort of unknown property, to be able to partner with historic royal palaces, with the University of Exeter and with Powder Room Castle to use their research, use their expertise to help us bring these stories to life. It's an amazing opportunity. So all of that, that research work and partnership is going to collaborate mm-hmm. this summer in a project called Hosting Henry VIII, which is a three-pronged project. There's going to be some elements taking part and events happening in Exeter in the middle of June, and then another few days at Powderham Castle itself. And then the project will finish here at West Horsley Place, or probably we should start calling it the King's Manor of Horsley,
yes.
because that's what's on the inventory, in the final week of July. So from the 27th of July to the 1st of August, actually over the date that we know he was here in 1533, nice. Which was the 29th of nice. July. And we're going to take all of that research, all of that expertise. We've been talking to craftspeople, artisans, artists, academics, food historians. And the aim is to turn the academic information and the research into something that's really innovative, really immersive, really fun, really accessible, a different way for people to come and learn about history rather than sort of being taken on a tour or reading a board. What we're going to do is actually transform this space so it looks something closer to what it might have looked like in 1533. And thanks to Anthony and thanks to James and the research that they've done, costumes have been commissioned that are, you know, authentic replicas of what we know the Courtenays might have been wearing when they were hunting. So the Little Lord's outfit, we've got, we're having a replica made of Gertrude's bow and arrows, because I, for one, was amazed that women were out hunting and shooting things and that children were too. So we really want to sort of tell those stories.
Yeah.
We've also commissioned a food historian to create some recipes based on the menu that we know was served. Sadly, we're not allowed to serve people gannet or sparrow, or I can't remember what else is on there, but, you know, some things that we might balk at slightly these days. But there is a lot of it that actually is surprisingly familiar and surprisingly accessible. So we're going to have a little sort of film about what they would have eaten and why and what would have gone into the preparation, and some recipes available that people can make at home, but also some little actual morsels from the menu that you can try when you're in the space. And we will also have some costumed interpreters who, purely based on the research and the information coming out from the inventories, from the archive, we'll be playing Henry VIII, Henry Courtenay, Gertrude Courtenay, and visitors will be able to talk to them, and they'll be able to sit at the table with them, try some food. There'll be music that's authentic to what the visit would have been like, and there'll be costume, jewellery, and bows and arrows. And so it's going to be...
We've got jousting as well.
Yes, so it's a six-day event. But the first 2 days of the festival, thank you for that, are actually a sort of a big family festival. So we'll have this immersive, authentic experience inside the house. And outside the house, we're going to have a display of Tudor falconry, because we know for the Courtenays, hunting was a big reason for being here and one of the reasons the king would have come here. And we're also, and this might be a little bit naughty, but we are going to have some jousting, because we do know that Henry Courtenay was sort of top of the list at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. They probably wouldn't have been doing any jousting when they visited, so it's, you know, a little bit naughty on that front, but it is absolutely relevant to the Courtenay story, and of course to the life of a courtier at the court of Henry VIII. So there'll be all of that happening outside, and lots of wonderful living history groups, so, you know, barber surgeons and commoners roaming around and people in costume, and they've all had the research shared with them that James and Anthony have been creating, so they know that we're telling the story of the rise and the fall of the court. Courtenays, and they'll be telling people why Henry VIII is coming to visit them for the weekend, and, you know, what's going to happen to them after he leaves, which is slightly less of a happy story.
Yes, indeed.
But then for the remainder of the week, from Monday to Thursday, we're going to be focused on this immersive experience in the house, and visitors who come during the week will actually be able to book a slot to sort of sit down with Henry VIII and maybe with Gertrude Courtenay, sit down at the table, chat to them. They'll be chatting to you about hosting the king, you know, eating the food, their lifestyle, and what life would have been like at West Horsley Place. And we're also, again, all based on this research coming out of the project, we've invited some academics, like Anthony's coming back to give a talk on Henry VIII, his progresses and his kind of role at Henry VIII, but also we're having a talk on Tudor costume. Brigitte Webster, who's a food historian, is doing a special talk on Tudor food and the banquet. We're having a concert by Ensemble Pro Victoria, who are an amazing early music group. And just for a bit of fun, we're having a theatre show called The Secret Diary of Henry VIII, which I think is going to be a bit more tongue-in-cheek and a bit less kind of academic. So there'll be events and talks and things all through the week that people can come and try, dip their toe into, and find a way that suits them to explore this amazing period in our history.
Wow. I mean, that sounds literally phenomenal. I could take up residence for the week. It all sounds amazing.
Please do.
Well, yeah, and I know folks. Actually, while we're here, where can people find out and book tickets if they want to?
Thank you for reminding me to say that. So if you could go to our website, everything's on our website, which is www.westhorseyplace.org. And the event is called Hosting Henry VIII. And there's all sorts of different things going on through the week that if you're interested, you'd be so welcome to come and join with us.
God, it sounds phenomenal. Well done, Claire. So on that note, I'm going to turn my attention back to James, because we are talking about what actually went on in this house now. Can you tell us a little bit about, Claire's kind of introduced what would be going on in here, but can you tell us a little bit more detail about what we know of the actual visit?
So we know the focal point of the visit is a feast. And we have, as we've already mentioned, the menu that we think is for this feast on the 29th of July, 1533. A rich array of foodstuff, including heron, which, yes, we won't be serving in the summer. Also, some more familiar game, such as partridge. And then, which do sound quite enticing, venison pasties. So Horsley is known as a great hunting park, and so we must imagine the venison comes from the park and baked in pasties. There's plenty of salad leaves, which might seem surprising to some of us, including different kinds of herbs that make up the salad, like, and herbs are quite unusual today, like purslane. So things that would have grown much more widely in the 16th century. And then some, again, some pretty attractive sounding puddings, spiced apple, dishes of clotted cream, which I think we have to assume is a bit of a gesture towards the West Country origins of the Courtney family. Clotted cream, a delicacy of Devon then as it is now, and pistachio nuts, so something slightly exotic as well. So a rich banquet is the main event. But over the time that those courtiers who come here with the king are here, also they're here for what they can do outside. That is to enjoy the parkland for hunting. Henry Courtney's household accounts tell us that he and his wife Gertrude have spent an inordinate amount of money on building up their own hunting equipment. Claire's mentioned that Gertrude Courtney commissions these remarkable ladies, as they're called in the account, ladies' bows and quivers of arrows. They're all being specially made. Henry Courtney actually sends to presumably his favourite bowmaker in Devon for his bows for hunting. They have made by tailors green velvet hunting suits. And there's one for Henry Courtney, and there's a lady's suit for Lady Gertrude, and there is a little miniature suit for six-year-old Edward, who would have looked very cute in his green velvet hunting clothes.
One of the questions I've still, after years of trying to find the answer to this, and I don't know whether you'll know, is what did ladies actually wear to hunt? Because obviously we had French gowns that were in vogue in the 1530s, and I've worn a few French gowns, and I cannot imagine myself, because apart from anything else, your sleeve gets in the way of drawing the bow. Did they wear more of the English-style gown? Did they have a particular hunting attire that I haven't yet come across? Do we know how ladies dressed to hunt?
I don't think we know in absolutely precise detail, no. I think we can only make assumptions about how These gowns and particularly the sleeves are adapted, because you're right. In fact, we've been speaking with the 21st century bowyer who is taking on the commission to make a replica of Lady Gertrude's bow. And we don't even know the full details of what an early 16th century lady's hunting bow would have looked like, or what its proportions were. This is a very physically engaged activity, and it's not just for show. The women are involved in the hunt. So we have to assume that she's got the space to draw back the bow. It is recorded that women do sometimes score a kill, just like the men do. So they can't be, as you say, they can't be dressed as they would have been for presentation at court.
Yeah.
Having said that, velvet is a very costly fabric. A full suit of green velvet is going to have set them back a good deal. So on the other hand, they're going out in fine textiles, nonetheless to do something very, very physically demanding. So this is where it's frustrating. Not only do we not have surviving examples of hunting equipment, but we don't really have it visualized in any contemporary illustration. You only tend to have in tapestries and so on rather sort of stylized, fanciful depictions. So this is one of the areas. We've got lots of descriptions in the accounts of hunting equipment being bought, some in London. The clothes tend to come from London. The bows and arrows tend to come from Devon for the Courtney family. This is where we want the research to go next, really, to see whether we can actually add to an understanding of what effectively a country house hunting party would have been. And I think that's how we have to understand this. This is a country house hunting party, but where on one day, most of the day would have been taken up with an incredible banquet. And it's not just the eating. There's music. We know in the Great Hall, they have four keyboard instruments to provide musical accompaniment. Two virginals and two regals, which are sort of miniature organs, like the kind of bellows organ you'd find in a Methodist chapel, mini organ. They also keep nine viols in the house. So they've got... at the very least, sort of string music alongside the keyboard music, almost certainly song as well. So you've got a feast that will go on for some considerable time, accompanied by music. Also, this, again, is the young Henry VIII. It's not unlikely that there would be some performance as well. Henry does like his play acting. We know in the early 1530s that at certain seasons of the year, Henry actually encourages the courtiers to put on a show, and the household accounts record costumes being made. Henry Courtney has been in one of these plays before, so it wouldn't surprise me if there is a play. Often they have a bit of a satirical edge. We know that for one of the New Year's entertainments, Henry has the court acting out a play where you've got some pantomime villains like Luther, who are among the characters. So music, some entertaining, perhaps some dancing. This is Henry's moment of great triumph, summer of 1533. The marriage he's kept secret suddenly can go public. Since the end of May, he married at the beginning of the year, but he doesn't have to keep this 5-month secret any longer. And he can share it in the company of his most trusted courtiers. And that's what this movement around the home counties is all about over this 2-month period in the spring, early summer of 1533.
Yes, and he can still bask in the delusion that he's about to have a male heir, of course, that hasn't been shattered.
Yes, absolutely.
Yet.
And there's nothing greater than the anticipation,
yes,
of that triumph,
absolutely,
rather than the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic description. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to the first part of this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. The remainder of this episode is only available to members of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. To join the wait list to become a member of The Ultimate Guide, click on the link in the description associated with this podcast. You will be added to the waiting list and I will email you just as soon as the doors to the membership next reopen. I'll see you there. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!